Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025, and our friends Ray McGowan and John Helmer are back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's get started. Jump into what's going on with the conflict in Ukraine. It seems that the United States have, on the part of the United States, they have proposed some sort of deal, a new proposal, as J.D. Vance said, a fair proposal. Here is what J.D. Vance said.
Very explicit proposal to both the Russians and the Ukrainians, and it's time for them to either say yes or for the United States to walk away from this process. We've engaged in an extraordinary amount of diplomacy, of on-the-ground work. We've really tried to understand things from the perspective of both the Ukrainians and the Russians. What do Ukrainians care the most about? What do the Russians care the most about? And I think that we've put together a very fair proposal. We're going to see if the Europeans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians are ultimately able to get this thing over the finish line. Again, I feel pretty optimistic about it. I think everybody has been negotiating in good faith, but it's now time, I think, to take, if not the final step, one of the final steps, which is at a broad level, the party saying, we're going to stop the killing. We're going to freeze the territorial lines at some level close to where they are today. And we're going to actually put in place the kind of long-term diplomatic settlement that hopefully will lead to long-term peace.
John, what is this proposal and what do we know about it?
We know a great deal about it, Nima. So let me go to the background and then the current what Vance has just said, because it's not negotiating in good faith. It's a deception, a grand deception that's earlier today failed to materialize in a London meeting and a follow-on meeting that Mr. Witkoff was going to run into Moscow. Basically, the notion that either you guys agree or we walk away is a US attempt to sequence two wars at the same time and make a lot of money in the meantime. Let me explain how this is being done, because it's been explained by two significant officials, Wes Mitchell, who used to be in the State Department in Trump One, who's in business with a purported think tank in Washington, with Elbridge Colby, who's the number three official in the Pentagon. Between the two of them, they've been arguing for more than 3 years. You can read exactly what they've been saying and what in particular Mitchell has been writing in The Last Dance with Bears that I've published. I don't think I need to quote exactly, but let me summarize. The idea is simple. The United States cannot run two major wars at the same time. Not a major war in Europe against Russia, not a major war against China in Asia. It could tolerate a smaller war with Israel running forward against Iran. But basically, the Mitchell argument, the Colby argument, is sequencing one war at a time. That means that from the Trump point of view, the Europeans should take over the front of the Ukraine war, while the US will purport to withdraw. They won't withdraw intelligence sharing. They won't withdraw coordination of commands. They won't even withdraw from Poland. I've just explained in The Dance with Bears that in Poland, what Trump has been doing is exactly what the Biden administration was doing for the last 3 years. They're building up the capacity of Germany and Poland, particularly, to fight Russia. Meanwhile, France, which is the next biggest power, and the British, the least of the big powers, will continue the war. And for that to continue, the two parts of the game have had to be staged. On the one hand, the US Rubio repeated five times in 5 minutes. Now Vance has repeated the line. Trump has repeated the line. either you agree to our positions, we claim it's fair. It's not fair, but they claim it is, or we walk away. The point is that the US will not walk away very far. And what has been created here is a very interesting combination of timing. On the one hand, the US purports to be walking away from the war in the Ukraine. That's not going to happen. Second, it creates a correlation of forces, a phrase that Ray's used and we agree about, which encouraged the Russian side to continue driving westward, which is what they're doing after the Ukrainians displayed their unwillingness to even accept a Holy Easter ceasefire. In this process, one war at a time, but big money for the United States, the US is demanding Germany, Poland, Greece, Italy, England, France will all pay premiums now for rearming their own armies. And through this rearmament program, these multi-billion dollar rearmament program, the Europeans will continue to fight the war in the Ukraine. But the US side will announce, we've tried, they haven't agreed, we're walking away. And that's a PR stunt on the part of the Trump administration. Now, today the press is full of the collapse of the London talks. The collapse of the London talks is based on not just Zelensky announcing he won't give up Crimea. It's perfectly obvious that when Vance says freeze along the line, the Russian side, he knows, will never accept a freeze along the present line, because that means giving up Russian territory in the four regions that are now part of Russia. So in addition, among the press leaks, it's been claimed that the US would take over the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, which is in Zaporizhzhia, is part of Russian territory. That's not going to happen either. So the US side has been making attempts towards the Russian side. We'll give them Crimea. On the other hand, we won't give them all of the Novorossiya, and we will insist on a European army protecting the rest of the Ukraine. That's not a demilitarized zone. That's not a buffer zone. That's not protection for Russia. It's no security in the long term for Russia. Now, right today, as the London talks collapsed, the White House log shows President Trump was doing nothing today, nothing. He's not even tweeted today, except to announce through Waltz that the United States has killed 74 terrorists somewhere in the world. Well, what is President Trump doing today? Is he still looking for Easter eggs in the White House garden after the Easter egg roll is finished? He is looking for Easter eggs, but he's found them. The multi-billion dollar rearmament program for Germany is a huge windfall for US military contractors, and ditto France and all the others. So the default position of the Trump administration is a very clever, calculated way of making far more money out of the two wars than the Biden administration had thought of. And at the same time as Wes Mitchell and Elbridge Colby push the notion of sequencing, the US will pivot towards the timing of the war they want to fight against China. Now, what's going on there? It's very clear. The United States, through Trump, through tariffs and sanctions, is trying to disconnect China from the entire trading world. when that was done to Japan, it was effectively a declaration of war by the United States, by Franklin Roosevelt, against Japan. Only China is far more powerful than Japan was at the beginning of World War II. And so what we have in the background and in the foreground now is an orchestrated set of negotiating demands which are not really acceptable to the other side. They're not a good faith attempt to get Russia on the one hand or China on the other to agree. But the dangerous thing, a very dangerous miscalculation that Trump is making, is that the clock belongs to Russia in Europe and the clock belongs to China in the Taiwan Straits, because right now is the moment when the Russian general staff and the Chinese general staff can calculate that the timing of US weakness is now. We delay and they will get stronger. The problem of securing ourselves against their two-war strategy, one war at a time, the problem is we shouldn't delay. That has a very great meaning for the Russian side, and it warns, and I've heard on your program Ambassador Freeman warn it, but not exactly in these terms. The timing is for China to say, let's go and take Taiwan sooner, not later. So this whole notion of a US strategy of one war at a time while we make money in the meantime is preparing two wars that the US is likely to lose.
Go ahead, Ray.
Oh, thanks, John. That was a really good recap of where we are. Let me ask first, maybe I missed something, but Witkoff was supposed to show up in Moscow this week.
Yes.
Did I understand you to say that that has been canceled or postponed?
Well, it's not quite clear over the last few hours, Ray, but Yuri Ushakov, the presidential foreign policy advisor, announced that Witkoff would be coming during this week.
Right.
And the assumption in Moscow was that he would come on after today's meeting in London. Since today's meeting in London didn't materialize and he didn't go to London, Peskov is saying we're not going to have strict deadlines or timelines on negotiation, and that the meeting with Mr. Witkoff has yet to be decided. Well, that's a polite way of saying maybe it will happen, but not on the schedule that was anticipated. So it won't be tomorrow, and it mightn't be Friday, and it might not be for a while.
Well, thanks, John, for that update. I hadn't realized that Peskov had said those things. Well, my bet is that Witkoff will go. I look at this through Putin and the rest of the leadership there in Russia as having an overweening priority to rebuild relations with the United States. And I see Putin and Xi, for that matter, being very, very cautious, being very, very gradual. Perspicacious is the word, I think. I think very adroit, too. Now, look how these things worked out since Easter. All of a sudden, Putin says, oh, we're going to have a 30-hour ceasefire. Takes everybody by surprise. Well, what does it really do? Doesn't hurt the Russians at all. They're on the march. Ukrainians are surprised, and they come out as the bad guys. Okay, first they say, no, no, we're going to keep fighting. And then what the Russians call the manipulators from the West to tell Zelensky, no, no, that's not good PR. Accept it. He accepts it and then, of course, violates it, as the Ukrainians are used to doing. So here's a little adroit maneuver by Putin to put Zelensky at a disadvantage and make him out to be the bad guy. Now, today, it turned out that Putin didn't have to do anything more. Zelensky did it to himself. He says, I'm going to show it up there in London where you guys are going to tell me to do something I don't want to do. And so their whole construct, this Kellogg plan, which he worked out with those not so bright Europeans, okay, that was a non-starter to begin with, all of a sudden falls apart. And whose fault is it? Zelensky, okay? That's what Putin really wanted. So the Kellogg business, well, not even the Ukrainians and not even the Russians are going to eat the Kellogg cornflakes, okay? That's been clear for a whole year, okay? So what is this? Well, this is the maximalist sort of thing to satisfy the hardliners in Washington while Witkoff prepares to go to talk to Vladimir Putin, okay? And my guess is that it's still going to happen. Now, what will happen? Well, I think they'll talk turkey to each other and work out a mutual agreement because both of them want to end this damn thing in Ukraine. And if the Europeans want to try to keep it going, as J.D. Vance, as Rubio, as the president himself has said, well, all right, give it a try, folks. We're out of here, okay? It's not my war. Now, the New York Times, Washington Post can try to make it Trump's war, but everyone knows that it was Biden that got us very, very deep into it. So what does this mean? It means that everything still depends on whether Trump, as I read him, and Putin, as I read him, have the degree of trust in each other. And I'll just say one more time, to hear Putin say that he thinks Trump is sincere, and that, in my opinion, says Putin, he can be trusted. I mean, that's big, because there's a long, long record of distrustful things that betrayals that the U.S. has done on this very issue ever since Jim Baker showed up in Moscow in February of 1990. Okay, so what I see is that this is the main deal here. This is what Trump and Putin want. Exactly why they want it, don't ask me to explain it in detail. But it seems to me we have to recognize reality, and if further proof were needed. As you probably know, John, you may have seen it, Patrushev, one of Putin's closest aides. He used to be head of the KGB, successor of the SVB, and now then he was national security advisor. Now he's very, very close. He and Ushakov are about the top aides with Lavrov to Putin. And he had this long article in Kommersant 2 days ago, okay? And the whole thing is about how the U.S. and Russia, Soviet Union in those days, cooperated. We were allies. It was equivalent to what John F. Kennedy said, you know? Never in the history of the world have there been two major powers that have never fought a war against each other, okay? So he's very upbeat in the process of which he says, oh, and by the way, those naval threats from those Baltic states, please, don't even think about trying to mess with our Navy because we'll use that. That's the thing that's singled out in the Western press. So what I'm saying here is that when you have Patrushev, you have Lavrov, you have all these other people saying, look, we want to deal with these, with the Americans, and we have incentive to do it. Why? Because we have the strong hands here. We can let Trump down easily. If he doesn't deal, it's going to be a terrible embarrassment that happens on his watch. So what I see is, particularly if Witkoff does show up in Moscow later this week, I see them coming to some sort of umbrella agreement, which will allow Trump to say, all right, we tried. We supported them for as long as we could, not for as long as it takes. It's up to you now, you sturdy Europeans with no army and no industry. It's up to you guys to help Ukraine, and Ukraine will fall apart, as was predicted this spring or summer, in my view.
John, you've mentioned the talks in London. It seems that it was collapsed because Ukraine refused territorial negotiations. And we had Macron's office issuing an ultimatum to the United States that territorial integrity of Ukraine is non-negotiable demand for peace talk. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned before coming live, you've mentioned if Zelensky was told to do that, who's behind Zelensky? Is that Zelensky? Is that his people, ultra-nationalists in Ukraine? Who's behind this sort of ideology that he has right now?
Well, let me go back a minute and just remind everybody, politics is a process of faction fighting in which different interests try to accommodate one another. If they can't accommodate one another, they kill each other. There's factional fighting in Kiev. There's factional fighting in Paris, London, and in Washington, and in Moscow too. So much of what Ray has described is quite, and I agree with it, one line of thinking surrounding President Putin in the Kremlin. But he's a politician who has to accommodate multiple factions. In the Russian case, Sergei Lavrov says there is no agreement on any points in the proposals that have come from the United States or from the other side. No agreement yet. I agree with Ray. Factional politics dictate that President Putin will express trust in President Trump, who has his own factional problems, particularly at the Pentagon right now. So what I see happening here is an attempt on Putin's side in Moscow to accommodate the faction that wants business as usual. They didn't want this war to begin with. They made no preparations at the central bank to protect $300 billion in reserves. The oligarch interest is to be able to go back to their homes in Manhattan, Upper East Side for Abramovich, and Washington, DuPont Circle for Oleg Deripaska, and so forth, and their houses and ski villas and what have you. They want business as usual with the United States, and Witkoff is representing the U.S. side, dominated by Musk, Thiel, and others, who've put their own officials and spokesmen into the Pentagon and elsewhere to push their need for multi-billion-dollar contracts. All of this can be wrapped up in the notion that business wants a deal, a ceasefire, a freeze along lines. That's not the Russian Foreign Ministry's position. It has very clearly set out, we want a security architecture for Europe and the United States that prevents us having to go to war again for the long term. The general staff have a different view, but a technical view about what threatens Russia, the hinterland and the new regions and Crimea for the future, and want to push the capacity of the Ukrainian state armed by the US, targeted by the US and by the European states, to push it as far away as possible with a DMZ lying in between. Now, facing all of that, Zelensky's no fool. The Ukrainians understand Russian factional politics, and their position is, why should we agree to anything at this point that the Russians will not agree to? And why should we concede any territory while there's money for us to be made? Us, meaning Zelensky and all his factions, if the war can continue in a somewhat differently structured way, the European, let's call it the European way. So without getting into the factional politics of the so-called neo-fascist group around Budanov in the Ukrainian military intelligence agency, I am not in a position to say what Mr. Yermak, the sort of alter ego president, the aide to Zelensky, what his ambitions are to replace Zelensky. But you've got factional politics in the Ukraine in which everybody hopes to make money for as long as possible. So they've said what they've agreed with the Europeans would be, let's call it deal breakers. The Russians, as Ray correctly put it, and I agree entirely, don't need to say these are deal breakers. They don't need to say it because they've said it before. No freeze along the lines possible. Putin has said it. Lavrov said it. Everyone has said it. It's damn clear. On the other hand, Nikolai Patrushev has made it clear we would like to have a better relationship with the United States because Trump offers an opportunity that right. Biden didn't. Okay. And if it goes down the business line and feeds one of the factions beating on the Kremlin wall, so much the better. But that would mean demolishing some of the sanctions, resuming Aeroflot flights to Washington, New York, and so on. It would mean recovery of Russian diplomatic property, the consulate in Seattle, which was seized and closed by the United States. It would recover the dacha in Virginia that the Russian embassy can spend their summers with, and so on and so on and so on. All of those things would be short-term benefits for the Russian side and satisfy all factions on the Russian side. But it's been helpful that Zelensky and the Europeans say, we want to continue the war because the basis of their war is Russia threatens Europe. And the basis of their rearmament is Russia threatens Europe. And the basis of Witkoff, Lutnick, Steve Feinberg at the Pentagon, these people want to make money. That's their real interest. And making war makes money. So that's how I interpret these words. The war will continue until Ukraine is defeated. But Russia's not going to say that to Trump's face. And they're going to show considerable respect for his emissary, Steve Witkoff. But Witkoff represents a bunch of positions, and they're not acceptable in Moscow.
Go ahead. Now,
just to comment that the Russians are not going to say that directly to Trump, but they are going to say that directly to Witkoff. Okay, they'll have to make it clear once again that, as if Witkoff didn't already know, the Kellogg cornflakes plan is just that, cornflakes. Okay, right. Now, John, you mentioned Budanov. He's a big figure there in Ukraine, and he said about a year ago, my God, a year ago, that we have till the spring if the U.S. arms deliveries and arms support evaporates, Ukraine's going to fall apart in the spring. Well, you know, I don't usually believe what Budanov says, but that appears extremely likely. So what we have here is a situation where Trump realizes, being a negotiator, that he's got a very weak hand. He does want to get this behind him for whatever reason. I don't completely buy into the theory that that's because he's hell-bent on making war on China. But he's got lots of things going on, like tariff problems and the economy is falling apart. Even the Wall Street scare Kravatitsi. You probably recognize that, John. When I used to read Pravda, I have to translate it without any help from anybody else, right? I came across these two words, Volstritskaya Kravatitsi. And they're not Russian words. Well, krov, blood, pit, drink, blood suckers, Wall Street, blood suckers. Okay. Now, Putin knows what they are. They're still around, okay? And Trump has to contend with that. The question is whether the Wall Street Kravitsi want a continuation of war in Ukraine. I can't see any reason why they would. They got plenty of other arms to sell elsewhere in the Middle East and so forth. So I think there's the makings of a deal there, and that Putin is willing to wait. He's in no hurry, as you said, John. And what he could, what they'll tell Wolf Witkoff, it seems to me, Friday or Saturday, if as I suggest he may go anyway, they'll say, look, you know, you guys are in a big hurry about that. We're not. Even Budanov says Ukraine is going to fall apart in the spring. You think those Europeans that are beating their chest with no army, with, as Lyndon Johnson used to say, all hat and no cattle, that they're going to rescue Ukraine? Give me a break. That's not going to happen. So let's deal here. We're willing to give you, well, I've always said that Putin is willing to negotiate on Odessa, for example, and other things that have not yet been captured by the Russians. And I think that's that, but that's going to take weeks, not just days. And what I see coming now is kind of a framework agreement where the Russians and the Americans say, okay, Zelensky is incorrigible. He's also insanely dumb. And so we're just going to deal on this thing together. And this is the framework, and we'll work things out, and we'll be out of there. The U.S. will be out of there. If the Europeans want to play around, let them do so. We've run out of patience, as has been said many times by our policymakers over the last couple of days. So that's what I expect. It may be different. I've been wrong before, but I think those are the equities.
John, what's the timetable on the part of the United States? It seems that the time, they're not agreeing on the time and the period of time that they can achieve something in Ukraine. Russia, the United States is totally asking Russia to move, to make some sort of agreement. Russia doesn't feel that much in rush to do that. What's going on? Why do they have this sort of disagreement? What does Russia feel about the timetable that the United States is proposing?
Well, in the first place, Peskov, the president's spokesman, the Kremlin spokesman, has said no strict time frames. Negotiations take time. During that time, as Ray said, Witkoff can come and go, present all sorts of proposals, along with the representative of the Russian oligarchs, Kirill Dmitriev. And it's always interesting and important to notice when Witkoff comes to Russia, who's in the room. If Lavrov isn't in the room, that signals this is a different kind of negotiation. Dmitriev's in the room. They're discussing business projects. Okay. And they're discussing deals that allow the US-Russia bilateral relationship to evolve and to accelerate and to improve for the benefit of the constituencies on both sides. Today's battlefield reports indicate, roughly speaking, 1,200 to 1,300 Ukrainian casualties up and down the line. Continued, that's the Russian Defense Ministry's report. They do not report Russian casualties taken to move each position forward kilometers westward. And there is an increase in unit size and therefore operational capacity and therefore offensive ambition to move against Orekhov in the center of the front. And that has all sorts of implications, both for the southward towards Odessa and northwards towards Kharkov. There are significant Russian operations in Sumy region, which is not part of the territory of the Ukraine that Russia wants to hold on to, but it is a platform for jumping into Belgorod region and Kursk region and so on. So let's just say that time is needed from a Russian point of view to clean up Sumy as a platform for attack on Belgorod, Kursk, and so on, one. Two, to increase the total area of Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, and Lugansk, the four regions that are still not completely emptied of Ukrainian forces, and to establish the kind of strategic mastery that drives drone, missile, and artillery threats to Russian forces and Russian territory further away than they can fire, the buffer zone, the sanitary zone, the DMZ concept. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. That's the Russian clock. The European clock is also seems to me quite clear. You have weak, politically vulnerable regimes in France, in England, and in Germany that have wedded their political future to war against the Russian threat. The most dangerous of these is not France, and it's certainly not England. All the English can do now is special operations with propaganda, deception operations, the Novichok story, and so on. The English fight now with words in the press. They do, from their point of view, a good job in deceiving publics. The French have nuclear weapons, but have no capacity really to project boots on the ground in the Ukraine. The Germans are a much more serious potential threat. And from a Russian point of view, Merz is looking like a Nazi. And that's been said. Former President Medvedev called the acting Chancellor of Germany a Nazi. Now, if, as my last Dance with Bears tried to show, the Germans combine with the Poles to use the transport hub, the United States, Rzeszów, near the border to funnel arms and men and material into the Ukraine, they think they can go on fighting a war and hold the Ukraine, maybe it's the rump Ukraine, at, and I'm using my hands to suggest borders, at least hold the Ukraine from the capital westward to the Polish border. And it seems to me their timing is a holding action. And they've and Zelensky knows how to read out the script that represents a holding action. So at some point soon, within days was Rubio's remark, within weeks, pardon me, with months, the US side has to agree on what it's going to supply in that context. The timing of President Trump's politics are today. They're always this morning's tweet, the afternoon tweet. As Ray said, he's got significant domestic problems of the tariff war type, of the inflation type, and so on. He's violating the normal war maker rule, never fight so many enemies at once, but he's fighting them all. That attracts and appeals and mobilizes the smaller Trump voter base, but it's slowly destroying the base that won him the election. He's lucky that he's not facing a real Democratic Party candidate, but he will find opposition at the local level from Democrats in 18 months' time. So Trump has got an immediate need to be in command. And he's delivering on his, he thinks, his program. We killed 74 people yesterday, says President Trump's tweet at 10:30 this morning. He doesn't have anything else on in Washington. The president's schedule for today is totally empty, but he killed 74 people. His timing is like that. Make a success of what he tries to do, make a fiction of what he has achieved, and always blame Biden, the weak, the sleepy Joe, and all that stuff for everything that was wrong. This is how he's running.
Breaking news. Trump is very angry. He says he's pissed off, but only because he three-putted the 17th green, okay? So he did have a schedule today, John. It was to be on a golf course, and when he'll get back, he'll take a shower, and he'll listen to whatever he wants to listen to on Fox News. Now, in a more serious vein, let's be speculative, okay? Why is Trump saying, look, next couple of days, we got to do this? And why is Witkoff still scheduled, apparently, to appear in Moscow? This may be delusional, but so is Trump. He sees a great big anniversary coming up, the 80th anniversary, the end of World War II. I was alive during that whole war. You weren't, John. Of course, you weren't either, Nima. But that was the key event of the last century. Now, why am I saying that? Well, Xi is gone from China. Putin is officiating, of course. All manner of people, even some EU people, are gone, despite what Kaya Kallas warned against. Don't go to Moscow. So it's going to be a big deal. I would not rule out Trump thinking, oh, I've seen those pictures of Churchill and Stalin. And Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt. I could be Roosevelt. Maybe they could get me one of those nice capes. And, oh, man, wouldn't that be? So, you know, I don't rule that out. I think that Trump would really like to be invited to take part, but that Putin would drive a very hard bargain with Witkoff and say, look, I got these generals, these admirals, these hardliners reciting to me every day the long list of betrayals by you guys on Ukraine. Now, give me something tangible that I can work with. I don't rule out that some sort of framework agreement to keep working in working groups and so forth will be instituted, whether Putin could bring himself to invite Trump to the anniversary celebrations is another question, but I think Trump would like very much to be that kind of statesman. I mean, if a Stormer can fancy himself as Churchill, equally delusional, then why not Trump style himself as FDR, including the cape and the nice little velvet on the top? Yeah, you know, the whole schmear. I mean, it's Yalta too. It's 80 years, for God's sake. Things are changing. Who would rule that out? I don't. Now, that's speculative, of course. But, John, I'd be interested in your thinking on that.
Well, we have talked about the possibilities. For one thing, it's already clear that Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, will not attend. We'll send instead an Indian marching unit and the Indian defense minister. We know that the president of Venezuela, Mr. Maduro, will attend. I'm not sure right now what the North Korean delegation will consist of, but it's unlikely to include the president. In the company of Maduro, Xi, Fico from Slovakia, President Trump's unlikely to be able to grandstand. At this point, we predicted that Putin would offer an Easter ceasefire about a month earlier. The US was taken by surprise, didn't know what to say during the ceasefire, and hasn't really commented on the failure of the ceasefire to cease fire. We have said that this sort of Yalta, grand Yalta notion that Trump entertains from a visual or theatrical point of view is one that the President Putin would like to endorse. I've been looking around as Ray was talking for my copy of the portrait that President Putin commissioned of President Trump, and I'm afraid I can't lay my hands on it. It's now been released by the artist Nigar Safronov in Moscow, and it's been published by CNN. And it's basically a photograph that's been colored in of Trump at the assassination attempt site in Pennsylvania with a blood streak across the chest, across the cheek, and with the hands raised and the US flag flying behind him. And Safronov has added a picture of the Statue of Liberty, and he's colored in the torch so that there's a little yellow flame of the Statue of Liberty showing a sort of eternal flame of both President Trump and metamorphosed into the United States. And that's the kind of thing that that Putin thought would suit President Trump. And he gave it to Witkoff to give to Trump, and Trump apparently loves it. Okay, to feed the ego and the performance requirements of President Trump, Putin has come up with a picture instead of a new set of golf clubs or a golf buggy, of which President Trump has plenty, and he can't rig the putting green so that Trump holds out. But this isn't theater. I've got to go back to the question that we haven't asked and that the audience will not see discussed in the newspapers, in the mainstream media, or in the alt media. Does Trump give up US hegemony in Europe? If he doesn't give up US hegemony in Europe, but wants to do it differently, the problem of working out a security architecture. Ah, bravo, there we are. There's the picture. Look to the left, mid-left of the picture, and you can see the torch is lit on the Statue of Liberty. And so, I mean, that's the idea of feeding Trump's ego. He's a politician, and ego has got to turn into votes, money for his constituents, which turns into more votes. Thanks, Nima, for illustrating that very well. The question is, does that man want to give up US hegemony in Europe? He certainly doesn't intend to give up US hegemony in the Pacific. I've got the last set of press statements that Mr. Hegseth made in the Philippines and in Japan, threatening China and asserting forward hegemony in Asia. Okay, does Trump intend to give up hegemony in Europe? No, in my view, no. He's not going to demolish the US empire in Europe. He is not even going to remove US troops from their locations in Germany and Poland. He's reassigning them and he's increasing them. And the question then is, what's his game? And getting from now, when there appears to be a negotiating failure, to then, which is a financial dividend on US hegemony, the Germans will subscribe $50 billion in rearmament supplied by the United States. What do we find? And that's where the question we're trying to answer lies. Does an invitation to the May 9 parade in Moscow meet any of Trump's requirements? I think not. Do they offend Russians? Well, not the business section. Kirill Dmitriev might be there holding Trump's hand. But there's a serious problem of his presence for most Russians. You've got to remember that Russian polls show the United States is now the most hated country from the Russian point of view. Does the president standing on Lenin's tomb represent a positive view from Russian voters' point of view? Putin can calculate the votes too. I don't think so.
Ray, here is what John is talking about, what's the main goal in Europe. But it seems that in terms of India, they're trying to do something considering that they want to confront Russia after all. Here is what Marco Rubio said. Then I'm going to play a clip with J.D. Vance talking about India. First, here is Marco Rubio.
Number one challenge on every front that I can imagine, geopolitically, national security, economically, industrially. And look, the president says this all the time, and I agree. We don't blame the Chinese. The Chinese have done what we would have done if we were the leaders of China. They looked, previous leaders in this country and around the world allowed them to cheat and steal and get these unfair advantages, and they took them. Why wouldn't they? But now it's got to be fixed. It's got to be fixed.
And how they're going to fix it? Here is what J.D. Vance said.
History Alliance will enable America and India to develop the most state-of-the-art maritime systems needed for victory. It's fitting that India, this year, is hosting the Quad Leaders Summit this fall. Our interests in a free, open, peaceful, and prosperous Indo-Pacific are in full alignment. Both of us know that the region must remain safe from any hostile powers that seek to dominate it. Growing relations between our countries over the last decade are part of what led America to designate India a major defense partner, the first of that class. This designation means that India now shares with the UAE a defense and technology infrastructure and partnership with the United States on par with America's closest allies and friends. But we actually feel that India has much more to gain from its continued defense partnership with the United States. And let me sketch that out a little bit.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ray.
India has an incredible defense relationship with Russia. You know, I'm sick and tired of these Ivy League guys using really nice adverbs and adjectives that most people don't understand. I mean, the rhetoric is bizarre. One of the things about India is that it's got not only closer to Russia, but closer to China, for God's sake. In other words, with the Russians and the Chinese pointing out who the big threat is, the Indians are buying still more oil from Russia and cooperating with Russia. Sure, they'll string the U.S. along. This is just bravado, it's rhetoric, and it has no meaning, it seems to me. Now, getting back to Europe, I mean, is Trump giving up on Europe? Does he want to be hegemon in Europe? Well, you know, they used to do that through NATO, right? We used to do that through NATO. NATO's falling apart. Why? Because of Trump. Slovakia, Hungary, other parts of Europe, you know, they're questioning, is NATO a real alliance? Would Washington really sacrifice New York for Berlin or Paris? Yeah. All these questions have come up now, and the answer is clearly no. So NATO is falling apart. And the bizarre thing is that NATO was set up for a specific reason. It was set up right after the war, I think 1948, around there, 49, okay? And the first Secretary General of NATO, Lord Ismay from Great Britain, described its purpose. He said it was to keep the U.S. in Europe, it was to keep the Russians out of Europe, and to keep the Germans down, okay? Well, you can understand that. Keep the Germans down was the prerequisite for peace. Now, what happened? Well, in February 1990, Jim Baker shows up in Moscow and he says to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, look, we'd like a reunified Germany. Now, these guys have just been through a war in which 27 million, count them, Soviet citizens perished, killed, dead, all right? And they're being broached. Here's the quid. We want to reunify Germany. Now, you can imagine how deeply they gulped at that. I gulped at that myself, all right? And then they say, what's the quo? And the quo is, we won't move NATO 1 inch to the east. 1 inch to the east, okay? Well, that was the first big violation. Within a few years, NATO had doubled in size, and there were all countries to the east of the East German border. So what I'm saying now is, here is Gorbachev, recently dead, or dead a couple of years ago, and very unpopular in Russia, despite what he did to free the Russians, okay, from communist totalitarianism. Why is he unpopular? Because he trusted the West, okay? And now Russia is being asked to trust the West again. And after all this skiing of betrayals, Putin is still saying, I think we could trust this one guy, Trump, okay? So what does that mean? Well, they look at Germany today, and Merz, as John, I think, said, Merz is being called a Nazi by the former president of Russia, Medvedev. I mean, he's acting like a Nazi. The question is whether the German populace will finally wake up and say, my God, we've done this before. This is not a good idea. I think there's new hope that that will happen and that Merz will be reined in, maybe even by the Social Democrats if they get some spine. So in short, as the Russians look out at Europe as the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Nazism appears, they see a dangerous Germany. I'm sure there are people backbiting and saying, right, we should have allowed a reunited Germany for a promise, not even written down, right? So those people are on the back foot, as one would say in Britain. But more important is there are Nazis ruling Kiev. And the Russians are not going to allow that, okay? They already did a deal way back in Istanbul, back in April, May, of 2022, just 6 weeks after the war. That included some reins on the Nazis in Kiev. They're not going to stand for that. So as they look out from the podium, they see a Europe that's divided. NATO is no longer a real threat to them. It was a threat, okay? People say, well, why did NATO be created at all? Well, because of the Warsaw Pact, those six satellites and Russia, they were a threat. Well, I got news for you, folks. NATO was created 4 or 5 years before the Warsaw Pact, okay? So we have to get our history straight. The Russians have their history straight. They know that they lost 27 million in World War II. They know that we lost 400,000, that we, the United States, 400,000, all soldiers, okay? Look at the disparity there. And they're not going to put up with a lot of stuff. If Trump wants to come to those celebrations, he's got to pay a very heavy price, and it's got to be doverai, no proverai. It's got to be guaranteed and, what's the word, reinforced, trust, but it's got to be verified, okay? So that's how I look at it anyway. John, you may have comments on that.
Well, we agree in looking at things from a different perspective. So our disagreements look more substantive than they are. The question is, what's the evidence of US intention as shown not by a Trump tweet and not by a Waltz tweet and not by a Rubio repetition. Rubio, Hegseth, Waltz are useful idiots. Vance is a more intelligent, calculating man, and he's the successor if Trump falls. These people do not intend, in my view, to withdraw the United States military capacity and economic capacity, because they go together. It's an extortion racket. There's a Russian threat. We will sell you the weapons. You increase your GDP and pay us more to protect you from them. That's the formula. It's the formula in Wes Mitchell's one war at a time strategy, which turned into slogans that Trump used during the campaign and will turn into policy that Eldridge Colby will implement at the Pentagon, where the brains are underneath Hegseth. Now, if this is the strategy, it's differently structured from the way the Biden administration organized the rearmament of Poland. It's different from the way the Biden administration and the Democrats planned for rearmament of Germany. But it's different, more financially beneficial to Trump's constituents, but it makes Germany a rising new threat on the, let's call it, the central front. And from a German point of view, from a US point of view, the objective is exactly what Mitchell said in the papers he delivered to the Trump campaign a year ago. Block Russia, impose costs on Russia on the Ukrainian battlefield, use the Ukraine as a buffer for Poland, buffer for Germany. But the question then is what size buffer they're able to create or sustain or maintain. And that's their military problem now as the Russians move westward. But NATO is increasing its level of threat, not so much in the Baltics, which make noise all the time. The Estonians announced they're going to put in 200 men in a base at the Russian border called Narva, and it's laughable. But what's not laughable is Vance's trip to Greenland, is the US attempt to build from Finland up to the Arctic and along the northern route, as the Russians call it, a new NATO war front against Russia to constrain Russia's northern transportation links, its development of oil, gas, and other resources above the Arctic Circle. That's where NATO, as a collaborative with US backing in Greenland, yes, there's a friction with Denmark, but no, there's no abandonment of the theory of NATO blocking Russia, NATO increasing the pressure on Russia on all fronts. And that, of course, includes the southern front around Iran, which we haven't had time to talk about today. And it includes pressure from Japan, with US backing on Russia's Pacific coast. So I don't see NATO collapsing. I see NATO reorienting itself as the US insists it should reorient itself for the US benefit. If we all agree that Trump has no intention of abandoning US hegemony in Europe, then our task for people listening to us and for us and for people who write and analyze the evidence is to figure out how this reconstruction will work on the US side, the NATO side. What we do know is it has nothing in common. It does not agree with the security structure, the reciprocal non-aggression pact, which the Russian Foreign Ministry tabled December 17, 2021, which Mr. Lavrov has repeated as on the table now. That framework allows a much reduced threat from east of Germany, and it proposes the basis for a better non-aggression relationship with Germany. But in my view, there will never be US acceptance of a German-Russian partnership. Never. So, because if there were to be that, US hegemony in Europe is finished. And all the financial benefits, dividends, and what have you that Trump, Musk, Thiel, Feinberg at the Pentagon, and all the others who are in the trough aiming to make money. All of them will lose, and I don't see that happening. I agree with Ray. It would be nice. It would be beneficial for all of us, Americans, Europeans, and Russians, if this wasn't the case. But I'm not at all convinced that what we understand to be good is what the U.S. empire builders in Europe, the Trump version of the U.S. empire builders in Europe, have in mind.
Now, let me just comment briefly. Reality has to enter into the equation here. NATO is nothing without the United States. Nothing. The head of NATO, a fellow named Trump, has said Biden is passé. Russia has no intention of taking over Poland or the Baltic states or even all of Ukraine. So don't think about Russia as being a threat to Europe. We don't. We think you can deal with the Russians. They are no threat. That's why we don't have any 155 millimeter artillery shells. We never expected them to be a threat. The Soviet Union fell apart in 1999 or 20 or whatever, at the end of the century, okay? So if that is the case, if that's the way the Americans look at things, the Europeans are still trying to make their peace with that. They can't understand it. And for now, the military industrial complex in Europe is holding sway, and the Germans are doing strange things like canceling their budgetary restraints on building arms and going into debt and all that kind of stuff. But that's gonna peter away, it seems to me, as soon as it is agreed that Russia is not a threat to Europe. And that's why they have no industry. That's why they have no real weapons. So why don't they just say, all right, well, we thought it was a threat. We don't want to spend all this money on things that detract or replace the money we put into social services. We're going to become a prosperous Western Europe, and we'll just have to say, well, maybe Trump is right. Maybe Russia isn't a threat anymore. That'll take months, years, okay? But that's how I see this evolving. I see NATO as not being relevant anymore. Article 5 is just a nice fiction of the past. It never was very real. And without that, what do the Europeans have? Just rhetoric and people like Stormer and Metz and Macron beating their breasts as if they were Napoleon, as if they were Churchill, you know, as if they were, German predecessors.
John, before wrapping up this session, let's talk about what has happened between Iran and the United States. We talked about it before last week, before the second round of negotiations between Iran and the United States. We know how Witkoff was somehow changing the rhetoric on the part of the United States, but that wasn't the case for the negotiations. Right after the talks, both parties evaluated the talks as positive. And here is what Donald Trump tweeted and posted yesterday. He said, I've just spoken to Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, related to numerous subjects, including trade, Iran, etc. The call went very well, and we are on the same side of every issue. What does that mean to you?
I think Ray and I know how to read Pravda. You read things between the lines, and you read the apparent meaning back to front. It means that, in my view, it means that Trump is not agreeing to an Israeli-U.S. combined attack on Iran. And we've recently seen some evidence that there's significant opposition at the top of the Pentagon. There's been, and we haven't the time to talk about it, the dismissal of three very senior staff men, Caldwell and Carroll, and I've forgotten the third guy's name, a reassignment of the chief of staff of Hegseth and so on, a very significant level that's been of opposition to each other. And some of it's been characterized as opposition to a war against Iran. We've now seen the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Kane, take over. And although he's a special operations man, I don't think he wants a major air naval war with Iran. He might fancy some special operations, but not a full-scale war. And the indications seem to me, but I'm far away from the Pentagon, that there is a significant level of opposition to a war with Iran, which would cost the United States and Israel, but from Trump's point of view, the United States, a serious risk of appearing to have lost major assets and have been defeated. Iran can absorb the punishment like the Houthis, but it can fight back. We've said this before. So I think the way to reason this is that Trump is assuring Netanyahu of, in public, of a level of support, but that does not mean the US is going to risk a significant attack on Iran. And from Trump's point of view, he can keep sending Vitkov to Amman or to any other city in the world to keep talking around the essential basic terms that Trump walked away from, the JCPOA agreement to lower a nuclear enrichment that would be required for a bomb. And he can push the notion of the destruction of and disarmament of Iran's missile capability, but he won't get that. So better to keep talking and talking instead of shooting. That's the way I read that tweet.
Very briefly, Nima, I'd comment on. I agree with John completely on that. The real story is that Trump turned Netanyahu down. When they were together in the White House, Netanyahu hoped to get some support for a joint war on Iran, or at least a joint bombing campaign. And he was told no, and even the New York Times was able to get that story a week later, okay? So what does that mean? That means that we're back from the brink, it seems to me, on the possibility of a major war in which the U.S. will be either active participant or mousetrapped into by Netanyahu, who's been told no deal, okay? So what does that mean? Well, it means also that the remonstrations from Russia and from China and the expressions of very, very tight solidarity between Moscow and Tehran and Beijing and Tehran witness the fact that as of yesterday, the Iranian foreign minister Araghchi was in Beijing talking with the Chinese. The Chinese and the Russian stakes in Iran are immense. And they are warning Trump, look, you know, not only can Israel be destroyed, your best friend, but we can take out, you know, about five or seven of your bases in the immediate area if you dare to attack Iran. I'm pretty sure they're telling that. And, you know, you don't have to be an A student to realize this is a real threat because of the equities involved here. So on Iran, I think we've stepped back from the brink. And I don't know who got to Trump. Maybe it was Tulsi Gabbard. Maybe it was somebody briefing the Defense Department saying, look, my God, you know, this is what we'll have to deal with if we either strike Iran or we allow the Israelis to mousetrap us into joining them in striking Iran. I hope you agree with that, John. I think you do.
I do. I think what dawned was reality. Call it Tulsi Gabbard, call it General Kane, call it Steven Weinberg at the Pentagon, call it anyone you like. The fact is that the Iran war in the Mitchell-Colby strategy for Trump, which they started to write 3 years ago and have been paid since then to keep writing, and now they're in a position to implement, A war in Iran is not one of the wars they want the US to fight. It's not a priority. And it risks losses, which would then overshadow the projection of US capability against China. China understands this perfectly well. So Araghchi was last Monday, if I'm not mistaken, in Moscow, and now he's in Beijing. And as Ray says, we agree. The solidarity shows the reality for the Trump administration. Iran, a war against Iran is not worth the candle, not worth an Israeli candle.
Thank you so much, Ray and John, for being with us today. Great
pleasure. Most welcome, John. Most welcome, Nima.
Nima.
Thanks, John.